seem clean. Fine. I'll stand for focus. Testing.
To us in the spring. Today, we are delighted to welcome Senator Edward M. Kennedy, who will talk about foreign policy issues. Reasons of announcement. Be clone with speech. This is very important, and we ask for, and we know that we'll receive, your full cooperation. Now, at this time, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Council President John Riley, who will introduce Senator Kennedy. John.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. As the 1980 presidential campaign moves now into an intensive phase, it's a great pleasure to welcome back to the Council a public official who has appeared on Council platforms a number of times in recent years, Senator Edward Kennedy. When he was introduced from this platform a year ago, where he opened the lecture forum series, I did not imagine, nor perhaps did he, that we would have the pleasure of having him back so soon, this time to appear in the Meet the Candidate series, which the Council presents during each presidential campaign. Popular in some quarters today, see for the Democratic nomination for president. Today, in his first major foreign policy address as a candidate, he will discuss the question, American security. It's a great pleasure to introduce Senator Edward Kennedy.
Thank you very much, John Riley and Richard Thomas, Congressman Paul Simon, who's been kind enough to join with us here today. This is my fourth visit with the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. Over the years, you and I have shared a dialogue about the great foreign policy issues, from the Soviet-American relations to the U.S. role in Latin America. Now you're beginning a series of discussions with presidential candidates of 1980, and you can look forward to some very interesting proposals. I understand that Ronald Reagan's speech to the Council will propose that the U.S. recognize the Holy Roman Empire. And Jerry Brown will propose that the United States recognize the planet Jupiter. And President Carter is going to announce a new era of detente between Washington and Chicago. It is a pleasure to meet again with the members of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. From a city in the heartland of the nation, you in this forum look across the seas to the challenges America faces in the wider world. First, I want to say a brief word about the events in Iran. And although I have stated this position repeatedly over the period of the past days, I'd like to just mention it very briefly to you again today. Our primary concern is the safe and early release of our fellow citizens now being held as hostages in Tehran. I fully support our country's efforts to free them. Whatever the grievances against the Shah and his regime, there is no justification for the terrorist actions and outlaw conduct. All Americans condemn this flagrant violation of international law. We are one nation, indivisible in our determination to protect our diplomats everywhere in the world and never to submit to blackmail anywhere in the world. At the same time, our commitment to the release of the hostages does not mean that this nation must condone the Shah and the record of his regime. Support for the hostages does not mean support for the Shah. And for this reason, I expressed my concern last week about the possibility of granting permanent political asylum to the Shah. And I was pleased that the Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, assured the Senate that no such step would be taken without full consultation in advance with the elected representatives of the American people. I believe that in the 1980s, America can look to the wider world and lead with a new sense of confidence. There are too many today who see a false image of the United States. They see temporary stumbling as evidence of permanent disability. They suspect that we cannot stand up for our interests and speak up for our ideals. I reject that vision and that verdict. I do not believe that any of us would trade America's place in the world with any other nation. We can regain the productive capacity of our industry and sustain the abundance of our agriculture. We can reclaim our leadership in technological innovation and renew the vitality of our economy. Defense is the cornerstone of foreign policy, but the foundation is the strength and prosperity of our society. National security begins at home. We will be weak in the world so long as the dollar is weak. We will be insecure in the world so long as inflation subverts our economy. And we will be diminished in the world so long as others dictate the terms of our energy supply. The day is past when foreign policy fit into a neat category of its own, separate from other great issues. In the year ahead, every speech on the economy or energy, in effect, will also be a speech on foreign policy. Unless we can restore our economy and resolve our energy crisis, our potential role in the world will continue to be questioned by our allies and challenged by our adversaries. At the same time, forces of change and instability are erupting around the globe. Nations are insensitive and ineffective in meeting the plight of refugees or the continuing shame of global hunger. We also witness the emergence of new centers of political and economic power. Revolutionary upheavals, religious nationalism, and regional conflicts test American resolve. The Yankee trader is being out-traded in the global marketplace. 10 years ago, we had barely heard of OPEC. Today, its shadow falls across every American factory, farm, and home. These are the new realities of foreign policy that will confront us in the decade of the 1980s. And we must face the fact that the old danger now intrudes with a new and threatening reality. We must deal with the dual danger of a Soviet arsenal of mounting weaponry and a Soviet policy of constant probing wherever they see opportunity and vulnerability. The painful lesson of the past is that we cannot act as a world policeman. But the emerging lesson of Iran is that we cannot withdraw into heedless hibernation from the world. The military balance between the United States and the Soviet Union is central to our national defense. What makes the present situation so different from the past is the approximate military parity between our two countries. It took the Soviets almost 3 decades to match our power. They have spent vast sums on their military at the expense of their consumer economy. In all probability, they will continue to make other sacrifices in order to expand their military might. The United States must not retreat in the face of rising Soviet power. This nation must never accept second place in national security. That is why I favor all necessary spending for effective, strategic, and conventional forces. And that is why I favor the current development phase of the MX mobile missile system with a full study of alternative missile and basing structures before proceeding with deployment. And that is why I favor the SALT agreement before the United States Senate. SALT enhances our security by setting limits on the weapons each side can deploy. The rejection of SALT would damage our security by removing significant constraints on Soviet strategic arms. it would signal a new era of confrontation between our nations. And the process of negotiation must go forward. Beyond SALT II lies the prospect of SALT III and the promise of meaningful reductions in nuclear weapons, instead of mere limits on their growing numbers. By the expiration of SALT II in 1985, the United States and the Soviet Union could possess some 22,000 nuclear warheads. We must find a way to halt this awesome proliferation of the means and mass destruction. A second challenge for defense policy is to strengthen our general purpose forces. The price of weapons has soared over the past three decades. Even excluding inflation, the price of main battle tank has multiplied by 10. The price of a standard fighter plane by 100. And the price of the radar and other electronics in that plane 1,000 times over. We must continue to develop sophisticated weapons, but we cannot counter modern Soviet forces with the arsenal of the 1960s. But few experts would contend that the improved performance of these weapons on the battlefield is proportional to their increased price. To pay for more expensive systems within a budgetary ceiling, successive administrations have sacrificed other values. Despite huge expenditures on defense, the basic values needed to keep a military force ready, reliable, and capable of combat have suffered. Quantity has suffered. While we do need sophisticated weapons, we must not pay for those we do not need. Instead of gold-plating every new ship, plane, and tank, we should concentrate on a significant quantity of weapons that can do the job. Instead of building one more nuclear aircraft carrier, we could buy 6 attack submarines. Readiness has suffered. On any given day, 1/3 to 1/2 of our ships and planes are not prepared for battle. Yet it costs only 10% as much to make a plane combat ready as it does to buy a new one. If we raised our readiness by 10%, we could add over 400 Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps planes to our active arsenal. Training and personnel have suffered. Many pilots fire only one live missile at a target every 2 years. Weapons are only as good as the people who operate them. The most important personnel problem of our armed forces is not recruitment, which is what the controversy over the all-volunteer force is all about. The most important problem is retention. Retention of adequate numbers of men and women with experience, skills, and motivation in the military service. As civilian executives know, if you cannot keep experienced managers and skilled operators on the job, you have lost the core of the business. The institutional memory is gone. Our armed forces have faced that plight for many years. The chief petty officers who actually run the Navy, the sergeants who run the other services, are forsaking their careers for the added benefits of private life. We must reverse the drain on our military forces. We must offer the pay, housing, medical attention, education, and other facilities necessary to conserve our resources of trained servicemen and women. As we enter a new decade, our defense priority must be to make our forces ready, reliable, combat capable, and in the long run, cheaper. In the 1970s, Americans spent over $1 trillion for defense. Because defense takes so much of our money, we owe it to the taxpayers not to play a simplistic game of numbers with the budget for national security. We owe it to the American people not to engage in empty debates over arbitrary percentages of budget growth. The important question is not how much we buy, but how our purchases increase our real military capabilities. John Stennis, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, was right when he said before voting against an amendment for 5% real growth in defense spending, and I quote, "Beware, beware of this process. It breeds trouble. It does not have the technical basis. It does not have the analysis. It does not have the recommendations except just the dollar amount." We must spend to be secure in fact, not for the psychic satisfaction of feeling that military spending is going up. The challenge of this era in defense and foreign policy is more subtle than mere money for military hardware. No matter how much we have, we cannot pursue our global purposes on our own. We must reinforce our alliances from Western Europe to Asia to the Middle East. We should plan for collective security and for other initiatives, political and economic, that will serve our common interests. In Europe, the NATO ministers will meet this week to consider how to enhance the alliance's nuclear deterrent. NATO should move towards modernization of theater nuclear forces while seeking force reduction on both sides. In the Middle East, Israel is and will continue to be a sure and certain ally. The security of Israel is indispensable to the security of the United States. We must seek to advance the peace process that President Sadat and Prime Minister Begin so bravely initiated. We must encourage the other nations in the region to join in the negotiations. And we must never give terrorism the stamp of our approval by openly or covertly dealing with the PLO. The PLO cannot contribute to peace as long as it has an oath registered in its basic covenant to destroy the State of Israel. In addition to our traditional defense alliances, we must also form a new alliance for energy. A NATO to defend Europe must be matched by an alliance for collective energy security. This alliance should provide for a more effective conservation. It should also provide for increased oil sharing in an emergency. It should offer every nation the opportunity to be a partner. But it should assure that never again will America and its allies become victims. The alliance should help other countries to tap potential resources of energy. According to the World Bank, 44 developing nations need assistance for oil exploration and production. This suggestion should not be considered to be a conflict between the consuming nations and the producing nations. I believe that we have common interests, consuming nations as well as producing countries. And we obviously have an interest to follow up on the recommendations of the World Bank to help the 44 odd nations that have the capacity to develop some 4 million barrels a day by 1990 to move ahead. But certainly as we are considering the question of NATO and our military importance, we have to, in a more creative, imaginative way, to provide the leadership among the developed nations of the world in the appropriate meeting of energy-consuming nations and producing nations to better rationalize both the consumption and the production of this limited resources, over these limited resources in the years ahead. Within our own hemisphere, we should establish new arrangements for cooperation with Canada, Mexico, Venezuela, and others to develop oil and gas supplies. Finally, in foreign policy, Americans have always known that the strength comes from right as well as might. On this 31st anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights, we should reaffirm our commitments to the rights, which have always been the highest purpose of our country. It is to the United States that people defect, not to the Soviet Union. And it should be the United States that people see as a source of progress, not the Soviet Union. Today, one-third of the planet is ill-housed, ill-clothed, and ill-fed. The refugees of Southeast Asia and the families in the huts and villages around the globe seek freedom from both poverty and repression. Our resources of food, technology, and diplomacy can advance our national interests by assisting their efforts to advance themselves. We need not be late to problems and short on solutions. Surely a nation that could deliver bombs to Cambodia, rice fields, in a matter of hours, can deliver rice to starving Cambodian children without a delay of months. Other times in our history have brought change and peril. America began as a tiny band of colonists struggling against an empire. We passed from one world war to another and into a Cold War that several times took us to the brink of final conflict. We have experienced success and setback, but in the long view of history, not the short sight of a moment, the nation not only endured, but prevailed. Let us be confident again, and let us summon and strengthen all the parts of our power, military, moral, economic, and political, and the power of our allies as well, for we are not alone. Let us shape a policy that will assure the survival and prosperity of our system and our society, and that can secure the ultimate triumph of our ideals. As Franklin Roosevelt once said, there are no limitation upon the nation's capacity to obtain and maintain true freedom. No limitations except the strength of our nation's desire and determination. Thank you.
I think that the devaluation of the dollar really rests on two major developments in the world. One is the failure of the United States to deal effectively with our own economy, primarily with the questions of inflation here at home. And I think that has sent ripples throughout the world and brought a questioning of the confidence of the dollar overseas. Secondly, has been the failure of the United States to develop an effective trade policy. The origins of that is the fact that the United States has not coordinated the foreign trade possibilities that today are scattered within the government between the Commerce Department, the Special Trade Representative, the Treasury Department, and the State Department. The decline of the United States market overseas and international trade has gone from 20 to 14%. If we were back up to 15%, we would effectively have a balance of payments that would be in balance and would begin to see a significant restoration of the value of the dollar overseas.
Senator, I have a question. Although you said in your speech today that you favor a strong defense, some argue that your record has not supported that view. You opposed the B-1 bomber, the neutron warhead, and the Diego Garcia naval base in the Indian Ocean. And one of the most important security issues regarding Europe will be decided this week, and you alluded to that in your speech, namely whether to deploy medium-range missiles in Europe. What is your position on this, and how does it relate to your previous record on defense issues?
With regard to the NATO meeting, I believe that there ought to be a modernization of theater nuclear weapons, but I also think that we ought to be tireless in trying to bring a control of nuclear weapons within the European theater. I don't believe that those are inconsistent policies. I believe that they are policies of strength and consistency and a responsible policy. With regards to the B-1 bomber, I think we have traded off the B-1 bomber for the air-launched cruise missiles. That can achieve the military or defense purpose, I think, more successfully than the building of the B-1 bomber. With regards to the neutron bomb, the principal purpose for the neutron bomb was a theater nuclear weapon for Central Europe. There was a considerable debate within the European allies whether they wanted that particular weapon system. There wasn't the statement when we debated that on the floor of the United States Senate. There wasn't an authoritative comment that was made by a responsible European leader that had been part of the Western allies that supported that weapon system. And I believe that we ought to look at individual weapon systems. Thirdly, on the question of the establishment of the base in the Diego Garcia, I think that we had to look at the particular moment about Soviet presence and tensions generally in the Persian Gulf. I think at the present time there has to be the establishment of a presence. Whether that has to be done with a particular base or through other means, I think, is a matter of debate and security issues. I have favored strong national security. I have questioned independent weapon systems. But I do think that over the record of 17 years in the United States Senate, it has been one of solid support for a strong national defense. It has questioned individual weapon systems, and I'd like to believe that it has also questioned the gold plating of weapon systems, which we have seen at a number of different occasions in the past.
Thank you. Senator Kennedy, there are quite a number of questions related to energy policy, which you alluded to. And could you tell us what you believe should be done to give the United States a more coherent energy policy, both within our own government's actions and in terms of dealing with other governments?
I favor on the energy issue, one, the development of a synfuels program, not the $88 billion program that was suggested by Mr. Carter, but more that would be more consistent with the program that was advanced by Senator Hart in the United States Senate, that said that we ought to build syn-fueled programs, but that we ought to develop the technologies before committing the sizable taxpayers' funds as recommended by Mr. Carter. Secondly, I do favor providing incentives to homeowners, to the commercial and industrial sector to expand energy efficiency and productivity. Third, I believe that we have to expand alternative fuel sources, such as solar energy, gasohol programs, geothermal energy, the winds and the tides, the range of different proposals that are generally considered. Fourthly, I do think that we have to meet our responsibilities in the fashioning and the shaping of a strategic reserve. The Congress has mandated the administration to move ahead in that direction. That has not been achieved or by this administration, and I do think that we have failed. Finally, I do believe that we should move, as I mentioned just briefly, on the World Bank study to see a proliferation of sources and development in the developing countries of the world, which I think can bring new sources onto stream and that can reach the whole issue of the vice-like grip that OPEC has on a price. I agree that we are out of the era of cheap energy. I do agree that we have finite amount of resources throughout the world. The question is, how do we cushion the impact of finite resource to our economy over the period of these next 5, 7, 10 years as we move to alternative energy sources? And I don't believe that we've been very successful in achieving that particular measure. And the final one was an expansion of the program that I've mentioned in terms of our international responsibilities of working with the Western European countries, consumer countries, producer countries, third world countries in a more coherent, sensible, and responsible manner. I just cannot understand why we can, when the United States, Western Germany, and Japan have common interests, common concerns, common usage of energy sources, that we've been so ineffective in working with allies to stop the bidding up at the spot market prices that effectively means that consumers here at home and around the world are going to pay more and more. And I think that is just one additional area where I think that we should be able to be more effective with our allies.
Senator, we have several questions here, as you might suspect, related to the